My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on payment efficiency. Payments has become such an important aspect of operating a successful collection agency, and there continue to be new innovations, new improvements, and new compliance concerns that are popping up on a regular basis. We're fortunate to have a panel of experts with us today to discuss what's going on in the payments industry. I'm very much looking forward to hearing what I have to say on this important topic. This webinar is being generously sponsored by BillingTree. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the armed industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a growing number of exciting podcasts for the armed industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use. It's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Russ Palais is currently the Director of Product Management at BillingTree and has over 20 years of experience in the payments and education technology industry. Prior to joining BillingTree, Russ led training and certification initiatives at the PCI Security Standards Council, and prior to that was with Blackboard Inc., leading payment solutions and e-business initiatives. Russ is a certified PMP and CSM, and holds a BBA in marketing from the University of North Dakota, and an MS in computer information systems from the University of Phoenix. Russ is also the 2018 chairperson of the Electronic Transactions Association Retail Technology Committee. Andrew Schaefer is of counsel to Sinberg, Ketter, Shepard, and Purdy in Seattle, Washington. And he's a commercial lawyer with almost 40 years of battle scars. He has defended collection agencies and provided risk management consulting services to the industry since 2002. He is active in ACA International as a Washington lawyer representative and is a member of ACA's CNR panel. With more than 26 years of experience in marketing and advertising, Dave Yeo heads up BillingTree's corporate marketing team. Responsibilities include marketing, lead generation, advertising, trade shows, public relations, marcom, and branding. Additional focus has been on analyst relations and new market penetration. Dave joined BillingTree in February 2010 after a multi-year leadership role with online fraud detection and prevention firm, The 41st Parameter. He has also successfully led marketing teams for Infusionsoft and JDA Software, gaining over 15 years of software technology marketing experience within the financial services, retail, e-commerce, and CRM verticals. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. There is no video component, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get them as the discussion is ongoing or when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Because we're going to be talking about some compliance and legal topics today, let me read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not his organization. Today's event is being recorded, and a recording of this discussion will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. And with that, let me start the discussion and reach out to Russ first. I know that BillingTree recently came out with a new product called the Account Updater. Russ, maybe you'd like to take a few minutes and explain what that product is and how it works.
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. So, in the current scenario where you've got a scheduled payment plans, you've got cards that are going to be run, say, a week from now, 2 weeks from now. The card date has already been stored; it's ready to go. But what if something happened with that account? Perhaps the expiration date changed, or perhaps the account number changed because the cardholder had reported the card lost or stolen and the issuer had issued a brand new card number. Well, in that scenario, what would happen is the payment plan would run, the card would get declined, which would significantly impact your ability to maintain your revenue cycle continuity. So with BillingTree, what we did is we came up with a solution called PayRaiser Account. And what this does is it works behind the scenes and provides the ability to automatically update credit card and debit card account information in order to minimize the occurrence of those declines occurring for one-time, you know, future data transactions or transactions that are tied to scheduled recurring payment plans where the cards are on file. Some of the responses that might come back with a card that's submitted comes back that would otherwise decline would come back to our payment gateway PayRaiser with an updated expiration date that we would then record in our gateway, as an example, or an updated card account number. When we get that updated information, then when the scheduler picks up that next payment plan, then the card runs, you have the ability to obtain that authorization. Whereas before, you would, for all intents and purposes, be getting a decline and have to potentially reach out to the consumer to get updated card account information, which is disruptive, obviously, to operations. So we provide the automation behind the scenes to make sure that your revenue cycle continuity stays in place.
So this is all happening behind the scenes, meaning like, you know, I've got my card numbers already in, and you're pinging the card companies to make sure the numbers are still active prior to a charge being made. That's all happening behind the scenes. So if I'm a client, do I know that the card number has changed, or do I receive a notification? How does that ultimately work?
So if you're the merchant, there would be reporting that would be available after we do a run, because we've got the direct connections with the card issuers. So we would be able to come back and say, these card numbers were matched as requiring an update, so that the merchant would be able to see the card numbers that were updated. To the consumer, it would be seamless. So when they initially contacted the merchant and gave them their card on file, they wouldn't have to follow back up with them to say, oh, my expiration date changed or my card number changed. It would all be automated. The merchant would receive the notification of the updates. The consumer wouldn't. That would all be behind the scenes.
And the consumer is still notified, like if it's a payment plan, the consumer is still notified in advance, just like they would have been under the old card?
Absolutely. So they would receive a notification, say, 3 or 5 days before the payment run. So they would receive that notification just as they do today.
Can you give a sense of how many transactions are declined or sort of not processed because the account number has changed, just to sort of give people an idea of how much sort of efficiency or how many can be gained, you know, by using a product?
Absolutely. And I think part of that is a function for how far out the payment plans are scheduled. Industry averages show that a solution such as our PayRaiser account updater will address those 10 to 20% of transactions where they're future dated and something happens with the account, some data element changes, but the merchant isn't otherwise notified and that transaction would automatically decline. So we've seen rates, when we take a look at other providers, when we took a look at industry averages, it's between 10 and 20% that would otherwise decline.
Wow, got it, thank you. Andrew, I want to bring you in to the discussion at this point. Reg E is obviously the big issue when it comes to sort of payment compliance. Maybe you can start sort of giving a summary of what Reg E is and how the ARM industry needs to comply with it.
Sure. First of all, Reg E, it's the Electronic Funds Transfer Act. Reg E is the regulation that implements the federal law. Only applies to electronic transactions involving accounts. An account is defined as any kind of a deposit account, checking account, savings account, and so forth. So if you're processing an electronic transaction on a credit card, the EFTA doesn't apply. So we're talking about consumers using debit cards and doing electronic checks to set up payment programs. And the rules are really not that hard to follow other than the first one. which requires that if you're going to accept a payment plan involving a series of payments, the consumer's consent has to be in writing to that. There's a notice requirement that you advise them of certain rights, such as their right to stop payment within not less than three business days before a contemplated transaction, that you have to send out a reminder if you're going to be collecting unequal amounts over a period of time. You have to send out a 10-day reminder reminding the consumer that they have an obligation coming up that's going to be taken from their account. If you comply with those several rules, then Reg E's not that much of an obstacle. I've seen clients that have followed Reg E on credit card payments, even though it's not required. I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. You don't invoke the law by following it. What that really does is, since the EFTA is a consumer protection law, you're really just affording your debtors a little bit more information, and a little more information is never a bad thing. So while it's not required, it may not be the worst thing in the world to apply the EFTA rules to all transactions, whether it be money drawn on an account or funds that you draw on a credit card.
So what you're suggesting is applying Reg E across sort of all electronic payments?
Well, no, what I'm saying is I have clients that do that simply because it's easier to ensure compliance on an EFTA regulated transaction if you just apply it across the board and you don't leave it to folks to decide when and whether the rule applies. So it's not required, and I don't even know that I would say it's best practice, but you're not going to hurt yourself if you simply adopt the rules for Reg E compliance with all electronic payments over time.
Got it. Now, with respect to this product that Russ was talking about, the account updater, are there any Reg E compliance concerns or compliance policies and procedures that need to be put into place in order to use that type of product?
No, I don't think so, because the statute and the regulations talk about accounts. So if a consumer's bank account is compromised and the bank has to assign them a new account number and basically close the old account, open a new account, I would think best practice on that would be to notify the consumer, get their consent again to the new account. And the reason for that is it's an extra step, but with this consumer litigation, we can often be penny wise and pound foolish. And the cost of being wrong and being sued far outweighs the cost of sending out a new notice to the consumer that we have four payments left. We know you closed your old account. Please consent to us continuing your payment plan on your new account. And if you do that, then you're not going to trigger civil liability under the statute. The liability under the statute, it's statutory damages between $100 and $1,000 plus any actual damages suffered by the consumer, plus the tail wagging the dog is always reasonable attorney's fees and costs. So a relatively inexpensive process, if not followed, can trigger a real legal headache in having to deal with litigation. I will say, I haven't seen any, I practice in Seattle, so I'm in the Western District of Washington mostly. I haven't seen any litigation involving payees on a Reg E claim, an EFTA claim. The little bit of litigation that has been filed in the Western District of Washington, mostly against the depository institutions, the banks.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you want my cynical but candid answer?
Of course, absolutely.
I just think it's the fact that the attorneys that regularly represent consumers in this arena just haven't figured this one out yet. It's just a matter of time.
It's on the horizon, I guess.
Well, that's right. And that's why, the more I do this, the more I tend to shy away from giving any kind of aggressive advice to my clients, because the cost of being aggressive, it rarely pays for itself.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I want to pause the discussion just for a moment and invite Dave Yeo from Billing Tree to say a few words. Dave?
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Andrew and Russ, for joining us today, and thanks to all of our attendees. I'd like to think that most everyone on the call should already know who Billing Tree is, but I want to take a quick second to just let you know Billing Tree is a merchant services provider that focuses on the ARM and debt collection industry, as well as debt buyers. We are able to offer credit card merchant services, as well as ACH debit card payments. And then we also have a technology side that integrates with your core platforms. We're integrated with just about every system out there for real-time or near-real-time posting back into your systems of record. So as consumers make payments, those show up as being reconciled. We offer channels, including web payment portals, IDRs, and to additional services like the payment account updater and SMS, which we'll touch on later. And it's interesting because the conversation here kind of went down the path of Reg E and connecting the dots of Reg E and deposit accounts and ACH payments to this account updater service. And Andrew, I think the topic you just mentioned there about reaching a consumer whose card has changed because the account was closed and reopened. I think that's actually the scenario where account updater, could not continue to retain payments anyways. And maybe, Russ, you could clarify the difference between getting an updated account card number as opposed to getting a notice that an account's been closed. And can you see the differences? And obviously, one would trigger a need to call a consumer and the other would not, correct?
I just want to clarify that if I lose my debit card and the bank issues a new debit card, cancels the old number, gives me a new card, but it's the same account. No, I don't need to give my consent to you taking those automatic payments again. That's very different than if I lose my checkbook where it's stolen and the bank says, let's close your account and we'll open a new account. And I get a whole new depositor agreement and everything else. Under that second circumstance is where you'd have to go through the consent. I would advise you go through the consent process again.
And Russ, I think that's kind of how the system works, isn't it? Maybe you could fill us in on the difference.
Yeah. So when we go out behind the scenes and get those updates from the issuers, some of the responses that we might get back would include like account number's been updated, or it's an invalid account number, or the account is closed. And so when those responses come back, there's reporting within our PayRaiser gateway that you'd be able to run, and you'd be able to see exactly of the matches that came back, which ones are tied to accounts that were closed, that would then require sort of an out-of-band process from the automation in the gateway that you'd have to have a rep reach out to the consumer on.
Exactly.
But one of the other advantages I think that comes into, using Billing Tree for a service like Account Updater, when you're using a different gateway, the reporting that comes back critical, not only because it helps you retain payment plans. This topic today, right? Somebody's typing in there, so I'm not sure if you can mute. When you're already setting your payment plans with the consumer, what happens when the consumer has to be called again? One, you're opening yourself up to a chance for them to dispute the payment again. I've been paying you $100 a month for the last 10 months. I'm not sure I agree I owe you that money. And then now they get into contesting the charge. The other side is every time you run a card and it declines, whether you're using Billing Tree or another processor, there is most likely a cost to getting that decline notice. So the cost of the decline you're actually paying for, you're going to be able to save on all those declines, even on the accounts that have been closed. So, it might be, a couple of pennies here and there, but it adds up. And when you channel only agents only onto the accounts that have been closed to get updated information, and you continue the payments that are already set up just because the card number's changed or the expiration date's been updated, You won't get the decline cost. You'll continue to get the revenue. It's better continuity for your clients, right? They don't see a disruption in the payments that you're collecting on their behalf. So for larger balance payments, I think it's a great resource that not only saves you time and effort, but also truly saves you money by utilizing it. And it is available, I believe, Russ, you can discuss functionality if you only wanted to use the account updater, as long as you can see your payment plans, card information, if it can be unencrypted from a token, and provided for updating, correct? Is that how that works?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. We have two ways that you can use this service. The first is that your payment plans are already on the PayRaiser gateway and scheduled out, in which case we already have those card numbers, that those cards on file. And the second is that, let's say that you've got an external system where you have those card numbers. You can utilize this PayRaiser service by sending us non-tokenized the card data in a secure transmission format, and we will then pass it off to the issuer, obtain the results, and then pass it back over to your system, your core system of record. So there's a couple different ways that you'd be able to take advantage of this new service.
Right. So something else that was touched on before, and I think, Andrew, you were starting to talk about that, is the written consent for a payment plan being sent out. And I know that the BCFP, I think it is now, gave some clarity a few years ago that written authentication or similarly authenticated. So if a plan has been agreed upon and submitted, one of the things I'm hearing a lot of talk about out there is around with using text messaging, right? So is there an opportunity in the collection space to send a text notice to somebody maybe on the phone that says there's going to be a link in here with your payment plan and you can authorize that? What are your thoughts on kind of the way that we can start using SMS or texting, for those of us who don't know what that means, with consumers in collections? Is there a risk associated? What do you think?
Well, sure. Right now, there's always a risk communicating by cell phone because of the TCPA. And, everybody has to realize the TCPA is only triggered with automatic dialing. But the FCC's definition of an automatic dialing system was so expansive. That was why the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, or I guess it was the Fed Circuit in D.C., rejected the regulations that the FCC had enacted. It remanded it to the commission with instructions to follow the law and promulgate new regulations. But we're a long way away from that. I think the one rule that we can, with reasonable confidence, say still applies is if you get a consumer's express prior consent to communicate using their cell phone, using an automatic dialer, then you can send a text message. I would never advise a client to use text messaging without getting express prior consent from the party you're trying to contact first, simply because unlike the FDCPA that has a pretty nominal cap on liability, statutory liability, there's no cap for a violation of the TCPA. It's between $500 and $1,500 every time you try to dial for dollars. So the best practice there would clearly be to not use text messaging unless you have prior express written consent from the consumer. Once again, very conservative advice, because the cost of compliance is way less than the cost of defense.
And Russ, I know BillingTree recently rolled out some SMS functionality. Is there a way to capture that consent at the time of communication? If somebody says, I agree verbally to get a text message and then back out, is there a way to essentially put a proof of authorization in a mini Miranda or something there? How could that maybe work in the ARM space with the solutions that's offered out there from us today?
There's a couple different options. One is that if it's in line within our consumer portal solution, that consent, there'd be that checkbox, there'd be that mini Miranda. So when the consumer first goes to the portal and they opt in to accept communications via SMS, it would be recorded there. But then also, if it's on the internal system and you're integrating, say, via API to our PayRaiser gateway to be able to take advantage of our SMS services, you know, there's the ability to sort of capture that consent out of band before it comes over to our site. So there's a couple different ways to do it. But what's most important is that that consent be somehow recorded, whether it happens before the request to send an SMS text via our gateway goes out, or if the consumer is visiting our portal, and then it's right there as they log in, would you like to opt in for SMS communications? And they click accept, and then we store it explicitly in our database. So a couple different options, but what's most important is that consent be obtained.
So the consumers had their phone number, their cell phone number logged, and they've consented. And I'm kind of going to try and tie all these back together, right? So let's say they're on a Reg E compliant payment plan, and the consumer wants to request the current status of their payment plan. They could maybe text to the agency a request that could return a link to the payment portal where the payment plan that they agreed to is stored behind a login.
Right.
And that's
right.
Closed loop system that would be all compliant. Is there any possible concern there, Andrew, you can think of if you've got all your dots, I's dotted and your T's crossed?
Well, yeah, assuming you're able to anticipate clever lawyers saying you haven't crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's, you're okay. You know, I was involved in some litigation several years ago, about 8 years ago now, early on in the TCPA's life cycle, where our client communicated by cell phone with a consumer who initiated the calls from his cell phone. And we lost that case. The court said that wasn't consent. And so if you talk with lawyers who defend businesses that are snared in the TCPA, we all scratch our heads till we're bald because there's not a whole lot of logic sometimes to what courts do on that. It's very punitive. And that's why any advice that I give with regard to communicating with a consumer's cell phone, it's really guarded right now, simply because we're in a space where the rules haven't been written yet. And that means that if you do something, you're leaving it up to a judge to tell you what the rules are. Now, that's okay, except you don't learn the rules till it's too late. And so I'm very, very wary about using cellular communication, whether it's voice or data. It doesn't matter to me. It's treated the same way by the courts. So you have to be extremely careful because, once again, there's no cap on liability. And the cost of being wrong on whether you've complied or not is backbreaking.
Well, and I know that's the theme of today is about, you know, using ways to reduce your cost of payments through technology and compliance. So your message there is that the cost of noncompliance is much greater than erring on the side of caution. It's not to say that we won't get more clarity over time, right? I think
that's right. But right now, I'd say stay tuned.
Right.
Because the reality is you may process 10,000 transactions without a hitch. And when you do that next transaction after the 10,000th, you may wind up really having a tiger by the tail. And whatever benefits you got from the first 10,000, you're going to give back more. It's kind of like playing roulette in a casino. You know, you may get hot for 15 or 20 minutes, but all it takes is a very quick blink of the eye before all of a sudden you're not playing with the house money.
I think we'll touch on that too in some other topics later in the call here on the use of no-fee to biller models as well. But Mike, it looks like there was a question that came in. I don't know if you want to pause and maybe we circle back. I think Scott had a question and maybe Andrew can address that and we can open it up for others too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was trying to think of, there's got to be, you know, further to Andy's point with the casino, there's got to be a joke about the house always winning in there somewhere too that I'm trying to find. But in the meantime, We got a question that came in. Does the use of, say, a home equity line of credit or cash advance check from a credit card as a payment instrument to the agency by the debtor trigger Reg E requirements?
Well, I don't believe it will, because by reading the definition of an account is an asset pool, if you will. So if you have a home equity line of credit and you have a debit card for that line of credit, to draw down, you know, that's really no different than a credit transaction. So I'm not aware of any cases that have addressed that. I think that's something that the questioner should sit down with his or her attorney and get that question answered. I don't have a bright line answer right now. My gut is probably not, but I'm hedging on that.
But actually, I'll tie that back to the account updater service. Russ, do you think in this case, if a credit union's offered a HELOC, right, and so somebody's paying off a line of credit, but they've been issued a card number from one of the brands, and again, they lose their wallet and call their bank and say, hey, I need a new card. I don't want to close my line of credit. I just need a new card, void the old one. What would come back on the account updater in that case? Would it identify that card as being canceled or reissued?
It would, yes, exactly. So when the request goes out to the issuer with the card number, the result that would come back would indicate, you know, that there might even be a message that says contact the cardholder, or the expiration date has been updated, or that the account's been closed. So yes, when that comes back. And then when we're talking about sort of notification back with that workflow as it comes in, if it needs to go back, there needs to be a communication back to the consumer, then, you know, we're able to utilize, you know, our SMS channels to say, okay, well, your account number came back, you know, perhaps if we can't automatically update the message, please contact the merchant, please contact the agency and provide updated information. So we could always sort of work that out to what comes back from the account updater service and how you may need to, reach out to the consumer and engage with them to get updated information if that automated update isn't available.
But if it's a card issued by any Visa, MasterCard, it's going to be in that report. It's going to be visible that
it is.
Okay, that's what I was curious about. I wasn't 100% sure.
Oh, yes,
it's coming
it is.
From a HELOC.
Absolutely.
Versus coming from a deposit account versus a credit card from, you know, Wells Fargo or Chase.
No, it's regardless of it's issuer agnostic. So if it's a Visa or MasterCard, then you will get an update.
Right. So, all right. Well, good.
All right. Well, let me just sort of step in here for a second, Dave, if you don't mind. Andy, I wanted to circle back one more question on Reg E before we kind of move forward with the next set of discussion topics. And I'm just curious if you could kind of summarize or discuss the most common pitfalls or where you kind of see collection agencies maybe make their most common mistakes with respect to Reg E. I think that might be helpful for the people listening.
Well, I think that, you know, just drawing on what I know my clients do, everybody seems okay figuring out how to get consent on a payment plan. I think the difficulty arises when a consumer is engaged in a conversation and says, okay, I'll give you $150 today, but I don't want to put it on my credit card. Take it out of my checking account. I bank at Bank of America, and here's my account number. Well, that's an EFTA. Transaction. It's an electronic transaction drawn on a deposit account. And in theory, you're supposed to have the consumer's written consent to that. And written consent doesn't necessarily mean you mail a document, they sign it and send it back. It can be anything that has an indicia of reliability of consent. I know that that the Bureau has said that telephonic consent is acceptable if you save it for 3 years or something like that. I've always had a problem with that because agencies manage so much data that retaining that 1 10-second sound bite of express consent to take the funds is a challenge, I think. In my mind, the better way to do it would be to invite the consumer, if they can, to send a written message, maybe send you a text message or send an email consenting to the transaction. But I think where I've seen agencies not really follow the rule, that's the most common one. It's a one-off transaction where the consumer gives the account number. In fact, I did one of those myself yesterday. And I never gave written consent.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Let's move on into the discussion and spend a few minutes talking about ACH and how that serves or can provide a payment option to reduce costs. Russ, Dave, maybe you can lead the discussion and start us off here as I get that out. Discuss the benefits, and then we'll let Andrew come in and start talking about the risk.
Sure. I'll start with this one. I think one of the things that, again, BillingTree has thousands of collection agencies that use us, and we obviously are talking about ways to reduce the overall cost of taking a payment, right? There's lots of channels that you can use, but when it comes to there's two primary channels. There's debit and credit card, and there's ACH. Well, with debit and credit card, there's a higher cost to process those payments. And then there also are some restrictions depending on what you're collecting on. If it's charged off bank debt or even just bank debt that's not been charged off, but you're collecting on, there could be a limitation on it having to be from a debit card specifically. So being able to identify the bins, what they call the numbers, on the card itself, so you can differentiate, is this card tied to a credit card or is it tied to a debit or an account? And then it all comes back again to our Reg E conversation, because as soon as we know it's a debit card, we know it's tied to a deposit account, we know it absolute rules of Reg E. And then ACH, it's kind of the stepchild in the industry to a degree, because people think of it as, if I get a debit card, it's the same as ACH. Well, it's not. I mean, an e-check runs across the ACH processing rails, and those are generally less expensive than the credit card rails. But in order to run that payment, you need a routing number and an account number from the consumer. And I don't know about you, but the last time I carried the checkbook in my back pocket was probably in the late 80s. And so when you get a consumer on the line and you say, we'd love for you to pay for this next 10 payments via ACH if possible. It may be a little bit more of a challenge, but I think there's a cost benefit to leading with it. And I think it's important to offer all the channels, but I think that it's sometimes if you don't ask, you won't get. And so as a policy in your scripts, if you're asking consumers, we prefer that you make this payment via e-check, which is probably more commonly known by consumers than ACH. Do you happen to have access to your bank account's account information? And maybe they have to log on to their online banking account and they can get that information, but training your agents on, giving some advice. Hey, look, if you log on, usually there's a section you can see in your about my account, and you can click a button that makes your account number and routing number visible. And then they can give you that information, and then you run those payments via ACH at a lower cost. So it's just a suggestion that I think can help you get, even a small percentage of your payments through the ACH rails. And then if they, they can test it and say, I don't have that, or I can't get that, obviously you want the payment. So you move on to the other channel, the debit card number, and then if it's allowable, the credit card number. I don't know, Russ, do you have any other thoughts on benefits there that you could interject?
No, I mean, I think you've covered all the benefits there. I mean, it's obviously it's a lower price point. You know, with ACH, you know, versus credit card, you know, you don't have that ability to go out and get that real-time authorization. So there is always that potential risk of, you know, in the old days they used to call it like, you know, NSF or, you know, the check going bad. In most cases that won't happen, but it is a much cheaper processing channel, but it does have some different risks that you don't necessarily get with the credit card world. So I think, Dave, you said perfectly. I didn't have anything additional to add.
No, but you did add, because that is true. I mean, you have to factor in a funding delay where it can be, 3 to 5 days to go through the Fed. In some cases, it can be executed by the processor. But you're right. I mean, if it's a matter of getting the funds in hand, you know, tomorrow versus next week, that's a consideration. But, you know, sometimes the trade-off of a few dollars versus a few cents to make that, collect that payment, you know, can make waiting a day or two extra, right?
And I would also say, you know your audience too, because there is a large segment of the population that is quote unquote unbanked. And so that segment of the population will not have a checking account. They will not have the routing information to provide to you. They may have a credit card, but they won't have a checking account.
Good point. I'm going to go throw back to you now, because kind of along the same lines as Scott's question, if a consumer's going and putting money on a paid card, like these ones you get at the grocery store, right? And then they're coming to you and giving you that credit card number, pre-funded cards. Is that something that would fall under Reg E, because it's considered some sort of a, even though you don't have an account to your name, is a pre-funded card a deposit account, or is it more like a credit card?
I would treat it that way, because the Act says demand deposit, checking, or like account. And so if I go out and get Western Union card for my son for $1,000 and give it to him at college, well, that's no different than $1,000 in his bank account. So I would say that I would comply with the Reg E notice requirements on a transaction.
And then, Russ, I'm going to ask the same question, because I'm still just curious. I'm learning about this account updater product. If it's a card that you bought at Safeway and you put $1,000 on it for your kid, and your kid's using it to make $100 payments off of a past due cell bill that they went and got the new iPhone X, and now they're paying it off to an agency, would that card show up if it had been they called and canceled that card, at least? Probably wouldn't be reissued, right? But would a cancellation show up in a service like this?
Well, it would go back to the issuer. So, I mean, the use case for that might be a little bit different, because it's got a much shorter lifespan. But yeah, conceivably, you would be able to go back there and see if the account number was closed or the account number changed. Now, for a prepaid card, the likelihood of that occurring is extremely low to nil. But yes, I mean, if it's issued by Visa or MasterCard, then if there was a request to go out there, in all likelihood, it would come back with what's called a no match, that there really is no update to it, because, as you know, we talk about, there's no expiration date for it. You could send it out. But the nice thing about our PayRaiser account updater service is, where there is no match, there is no fee to go out there. So if there's no updated account information that is provided, you're just sending that over just to see if there is any updated account information, and nothing comes back, then you're not assessed any fee for that check.
Well, again, I think these prepaid cards too, they're starting to show up more and more in some cases as payroll, right? Companies are issuing debit cards, and then they're putting weekly payroll into those. So again, they as long as they're tied to a card brand, they're still going to show up if the end user who's made the payment plan maybe changes companies and that's not getting funded anymore, and they're not, you know, that's going to come back as that card's been shut off. So at least save on the auth codes on that. But, well, good. So it all ties together nicely. do we have any other questions, Mike? If not, we can maybe move into some of the other ways to save some costs for an agency and technology, right?
There's nothing in the queue now, but I will remind everybody that we are we're slowly running out of time. We're got about 15 minutes left before we wrap up here. So if you do have a question, now would be the great time to to hit the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel, type it in and send it to us, and we'll do our best to get to it before the top of the hour. I know, Dave, we wanted to spend a few minutes talking about omnichannel.
Yeah.
And the importance of that. Why don't you kick us off there?
Sure, and I think there's two buzzwords you hear out there a lot. There's omnichannel payments and there's multi-channel payments. And while they sound very similar, they're actually, by our definition, a little bit different. They both involve offering different ways for a consumer to engage with you. Multi-channel could mean that you have a web payment portal and you have your agents calling in and taking the payment over the phone. And then you could tie in an IVR, interactive voice response, inbound for making a payment 24/7. And each of those individual multiple will accept a payment. But they are not omni-channel until they all three all talk to each other. But in the perfect world scenario, you want to be able to have a consumer go onto a web payment portal or onto an IVR and make a payment. And then people by future have the tendency to want to check, right? They might pick the phone up and call your agent and say, you know, I just made a payment on and my computer did something weird and I'm not sure it went through. Can you tell me if it posted or not? If it's a different service that's doing your web payment than your agents are seeing in their gateway or their reporting system, they might have to tell that consumer at that time, you know what, I won't see that reconcile until maybe tomorrow or 2 or 3 days when somebody runs a report. If it's omni-channel, they're running in almost near real time. Is that such a thing? In near real time or real time, so that theoretically a consumer could be on your payment portal and on the phone with an agent. The agent could run the card, and as it posts, it would show the payment being set, made on that date, and agreed upon. So those are the differences. Now the benefits, again, each different channel you offer, we are, you know, millennials are talked a lot about. I'm starting to see articles about Gen Z and the next up and coming, my kids, they're 7 and 11. They have nothing but tablets and, you know, iPhones in their hands. They were 4. You know, the cost savings related to paper mail, stationery, post for all the lettering, although they're still going to be there, but as much as you can make consumers self-curable and take away the agent's time from having to talk to a consumer about something they're going to do anyways, there's cost savings to having those channels. There's payments that can be accepted during off hours on web portals and IVRs. And I know some of this is somewhat obvious, but I think that you know, it's important to explore. We do our annual survey every year, and we've seen a pretty consistent upward trend in interest in adding an IVR. And we see a lot of our customers coming to us and working with partner IVRs as well, looking to add more and more functions. So not just payment functionality, but account lookup. I want to find out how many payments do I have left on my payment plan. Or again, tying it back to compliance too, some notifications. There are scenarios where if there's 10 payments in a plan and the final payment has the balance payoff, and this is the one that always gets me on the Reg E, so Andrew, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe even if the dollar amount on a payment is going to be less or more, so if let's say the final, let's say you made 10 payments of $100 and the very last month's payment is going to be $85 instead of $100, it's less than the amount they agreed upon, you have to legally tell them, what is it, 10 or 15 days before the payment, that the amount is different than the previous amounts.
The rule is 10 days.
So letting your technology be able to look at that and say, hey, we're on the last payment. This is, even if it's off by a penny, I think it's as literal as that, right? Any amount.
Well, you know, any amount means any. It doesn't mean more or less. It means
so
different.
1 penny difference in the settlement to close the payment plan, and it could trigger your technology to shoot the email or post the notice in the portal. If you've got the SMS texting set up, to ping them a text reminder, your final payment, you know, to ABC Collections is going to be, I guess we probably wouldn't want ABC Collections in our text notice, but your final payment on your plan is due in 10 days. The amount will be slightly different. Click here, enter the portal. Okay, it's going to be $10 less. It's my final payment. These are all cost-saving measures because it's the expense of your employee of calling and talking to another person keeps them from talking and tackling other cases, right, that are more challenging. Getting new payment plans from new books of debt that you've acquired are all great uses of human time. And the other things that can be automated will save your agency, you know, more than the cost of having that technology in place, and make your clients happier because they see consistent payments coming in. So that's kind of my rant on multi-channel. And I think we're all of the modern, you know, online age where we just expect everything to be there faster and to be in the channel that we want it to be in. Also having the ability to take all the different payment types. We don't want to hear, we can't accept the payment, on credit card. It has to be ACH. Well, that's a limitation that in some cases might turn off a consumer from making a payment. So it's important to all types, all the different channels, be a well-oiled machine. I don't know if you have anything to interject, Russ, or if I've taken all the thunder there again.
No, nothing at all. I think you've summed it up well.
Do you still see a sizable number of agencies, or collection agencies, that aren't kind of, you know, in this omni-channel or multi-channel dynamic yet?
So again, I'll go back to our survey. The adoption rate on payment portals is, I think, it's probably a statistical anomaly that it's not 100%, right? That offering a portal. Because it usually comes with most of the merchant services providers as an extension of the merchant account or the software, the core software platform that they're in. The IVR has been trending upward. I think it was in the 20s to 30s that either had it, and then, you know, the planned adoption was I don't have it in front of me here, but we can get copies off of our website, and you can see it's been consistently trending upward as far as the interest, and we're still entertaining. I think what happens is many of the agencies have dialers in place, and I know that's a whole other animal there with the dialing systems in place. But for making the calls out to consumers, it's the dedicated inbound IVR for payment acceptance and account update and maintenance and lookup that we're still seeing a lot of interest in. With our partner products and the solutions that we offer.
Got it. Okay. Well, we just have a few minutes left, and I know we kind of had we discussed or considered talking about sort of the no fee to bill model. Do you want to briefly touch on that for just a couple minutes before
we
wrap
up? Again, I think it wouldn't be a fair conversation on cost savings and payment processing.
Right.
Do not at least address that topic and say, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of ways people have tried to skin this cat out there. And then talking in this case, collections. We all know that Ticketmaster has been adding fees and costs to our concert tickets for years, and we all love them so much for that, right? That $100 concert ticket ends
Absolutely.
Up being $50 before you know it. You don't know why. But in the arm industry specifically, because of the heavy compliance and the state laws and the card brand rules, BillingTree does not see a way to be able to be both legally compliant and card brand compliant. You know, each of them has their own set of rules, and they both conflict in certain cases. So, you know, as much as we see the interest in wanting to offset credit card processing costs, flip side, the cost of business to take the payment, you know, if you use some of these things we talked about today, I believe you really can offset a lot of or reduce a lot of your processing costs without having to try and pass another cost or surcharge or fee, however you want to legally define it, onto the consumer that's perhaps already struggling to make a payment to begin with, and adding another $2, $5, $10 on top of that. has some great risk. And Andrew, I know you maybe have some thoughts on the risks associated with surcharging consumers, especially in ARM, and maybe you could close out the last minute or two on the legal there.
Well, the FDCPA, it's Section 1692F1, prohibits a collection agency from receiving anything other than the amount due unless there's an agreement allowing extra charges or a law allowing extra charges. Where I have seen cases that evaluate convenience fees from two perspectives. Some courts have allowed it if, number one, the consumer is given a no-cost way to pay, and number two, all of the charges passed on to the consumer are remitted directly to the credit granting agency. So the collection agency retains nothing in between. It's merely a conduit. Some cases have said that under that limited circumstance, and the important thing is that the consumer has a no-cost alternative and affirmatively elects to use whatever method there's the extra charge on. Some courts have said that's okay. Others have looked at 1692F1 and taken it literally and said it's not in a written agreement. There's no statute allowing it. If you do it, you're violating the FDCPA. And whether you can do it or not is totally dependent on the federal circuit, in which your consumer resides. And so if an agency is going to start trying to pass through some of those costs, it needs to counsel in surveying those federal circuits where it's allowed under restrictions and those where it's not. You can't just have a bright line rule that applies in all cases, because some cases
even,
okay, others
then,
not.
And though the actual source of the bill would have had to have had written language at the time. So if it's my Sprint bill that I'm being collected upon 2 years later, the contract in Sprint would have to have said that they authorize the use of a convenience fee for collecting payments should this end up in collections. Isn't that kind of the other challenges? That
would be clear in all federal circuits. I'm talking about some cases have allowed it where the agency doesn't have an underlying contract saying that in addition to what I owe you, I will pay the cost of collection. These are situations where the agency engages the consumer and provides an alternative. You can pay with your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express. However, there is a charge that is imposed by the card, the brand, of 1.5% of the amount of the charge. We'll collect that from you. It gets remitted directly. We don't retain any of it. But if you don't want to do that, there's another way you can pay today's installment without incurring any cost, and that's to drop a check in the mail or give us your bank information so we can process an electronic.
And that's
kind of
where we see the kind of the catch-22, right? Because the card brands then come out and say, well, you can't make the convenience fee a percentage base. That has to be a established upfront flat rate. It has to be the same on all channels. So whereas if you're trying to steer customers towards ACH to reduce your cost, the card brands don't allow for you to not charge the same fee on an e-check as you do for credit card, which is why, again.
Well, it doesn't matter whether you tell the consumer it's going to cost you 1.5% or it's going to cost you $2. It doesn't matter what the calculation is. You just have to tell the consumer up front, there is a charge. We don't retain any of it. It goes right to your credit card company. But if you don't want to pay the extra $2 on the $1,000 payment, we understand that. You can also give us your routing number and checking account number, and we'll just process an electronic check. It won't cost you anything.
So, again, it's not clear cut, but it's fraught with risk, and the cost associated with being in violation could be from the card brand side, a penalty up to including not being able to process in the future. So again, I think BillingTree's stance is that it's better to look at low cost channels, work with your processor, get your right volume transaction pricing, And consider, you know, as much ACH when you can, and use channels that reduce costs, like your postage and stationery, and limiting your number of statements and things you have to mail. But again, I know we could have a whole other webinar on that, Mike, and we probably will.
Absolutely.
I know we're at the top of the hour, so I want to be respectful of everyone's time and let you wrap things up.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. But like you said, before I let everybody, we've reached the top of the hour, but before I let everybody go, I want to thank Andrew, Russ, and Dave for their insights and their time today. This webinar would definitely not have been possible without their participation. I also wanted to thank Billingtree one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.mybillingtree.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who listened and participated today. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event will be posted to the webinar recordings page on the site in the next couple of days, and be accessible to anybody who wants to listen to the recording of it. And I hope everyone enjoys the rest of the day. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Russ.